Hello, everyone. I hope that everyone has a chance to eat something properly. So welcome to the Institute for China-American Studies. My name is Nong Hong. I'm the executive director of this institute. And thank you for making this happen today. So before I start, I would like to very briefly tell you a little bit about ICARS, because some of you have been to our previous event before, but some of you is the first time. So we are a very new think tank, very small one. As you can see, we have very limited capacity for hosting events. So, good timing.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
There we go.
I will continue. I'm just telling everyone what is ICARS about. So very new. So we're basically only 2 years and a half history, and then our aim is to try to facilitate exchange of ideas and people, especially scholars from both China and the United States. So in order to do that, we try to develop institutional cooperation and also research covering the issues on China-US relations, ranging, for instance, maritime security cooperation between the two countries, the trade relations, and the East Asia polity, etc. So today, I think it's a very good timing that we get together, because we have a couple of issues after China's 90th Party Congress, and also the President Trump's visit to Asia, including five countries, and we also have IPAC and the East Asia Summit. So it's a very, very a lot of issues that we can actually touch upon today. And all those issues, I believe, are going to have like impact on the future China-U.S. relations. Today, I would like to invite Dr. Liu Yawei, and he's from Carter Center, but he's also serving as the advisor member of ICARS. So I'm going to invite him to chair the discussion today. But before I hand over the floor to Dr. Liu, I think it's a little bit weird because we're a very small room and everyone's having this microphone, simply because this is an on-the-record discussion, mm-hmm. and we want to put it into our podcast. So I would like to remind you, like, when you start talking, especially for the first time, just let us know your name, affiliation. But later on for the Q&A or the free discussion, just every time when it's your turn or you want to speak something, just briefly tell your name so that we get easy for the follow-up edition. So now I would like to invite Dr. Liu to give the floor back to you.
Thanks for inviting me. I guess I'm the only one that is from outside the metro area. This is my fourth day here in D.C. You know, I was here for other things, but it just struck me that this is so timely. So I just want to share with you what happened, you know, in terms of my interaction, what I heard over here on U.S.-China relationship and on the Party Congress, and where this relationship is going to go. So on the first day, we're at the meeting at the USIP. There's a big Chinese delegation there. And Jennifer Stats, the China program director, was in China during President Trump's visit. And so that they were having a meeting of the international department, Zhong Lianbu. So he said all the Chinese scholars at the meeting basically said, you know, we're not sure about where President Trump is going when he was first elected. You know, at the Mar-a-Lago meeting, we figured him out somewhat. But this time, we got him. That's almost like a consensus from the Chinese scholars. And then on the second day, you know, I was walking to the second meeting at the USIP. You know, I heard there's this China Power meeting at CSIS. It's a webcast. So I was listening to the keynote from Senator John Cornyn. I was really struck by the tone of hostility. And he basically said China is a threat to national security. And he and Senator Dianne Feinstein is sponsoring this bill to prevent China from further stealth and also investment in the dual-use technology in the U.S. You know, it just sounded like, you know, your president has yet to complete the trip, but here in the backyard, he sounded so hostile. And then last night, you know, I was at this U.S.-China Policy Foundation gala. You know, every year they have this. So they have two ambassadors over there. They give an outstanding award to Ambassador Cui. They also invited Ambassador Baucus. So Baucus, in his speech, basically said, it is our moral obligation for people, our generation, you know, to make sure this relationship will work. I mean, Baucus was a senator. I mean, he used to sound probably just like John Cornyn, but, you know, he spent three years in China. I think he's a changed person. You know, when I was in China, he said he wanted to go to every province in China. He was even allowed to go to Tibet. And then Ambassador Trey made his usual pitch. And one thing he said that struck me is he said, the preacher now does not believe in the preaching himself, so he's, you know, directly critical of some of the quote-unquote anti-China forces here in the U.S. So, and then I saw an article by a senior colonel from the Chinese military, Senior Colonel Zhou Bo. He works at the Center of Multilateral Collaboration at the Defense Ministry, in which he said China will make a special contribution to peacekeeping in the world. And in particular, he said, we'd like to work with the U.S., particularly on the peacekeeping front. So you have all the, you know, I can call this sound and fury here in D.C., in a policy town, that you have so many. And then, of course, President Trump's speech yesterday afternoon, you know, the drinking water and all of that. And then he just walked out after he said this is the epic visit, right, to Asia and the best ever visit. So that's, I guess, what we're going to do is to evaluate, to assess what this trip means and also the Party Congress. So Dr. Hong has given us a list of six, I think, questions. This is a round table, so we'll go around the table. I think, you know, we have 120 minutes, we'll have 12 people here. Each at maximum will have 10 minutes. So I guess the first round, maybe 2 to 3 minutes on any of the six. If you have something that you really want to get it out, like Bob, when Bob walked in, I heard him say, I'm witnessing the decline of an empire. I don't know which empire you're talking about, so we'll start with you.
Bob from the Atlantic Council. Let me just make a few quick comments on the overall trip. I think this was kind of a test of, you know, what is Trump's replacement for the pivot. What is his vision for Asia? And I think both the good news and the bad news was he clearly defined his policy. I think it was somewhat incoherent because I don't think America First is compatible with a free and open Indo-Pacific. And I think that was obvious when he started talking about trade. Trashing the WTO, trashing all multilateral trade deals, and the only vision I could see for the future of trade is the 1930s all over again. So I'm very concerned about that, and I think the perception in Asia is a bit like Angela Merkel's perception after they met with a few meetings with Trump, where she said we can't rely on the U.S. anymore. On the other hand, in terms of this was the most professionally managed trip of the Trump administration. I think the first leg of it in Japan and Korea were designed to project continuity, underpinning our alliances, and so on. And he did a fair amount of that. But even there were undercurrents. You know, Abe tried to persuade him to come back to TPP, and he refused, and they're talking about that, you know, there's, as far as I can see, there is zero interest in Asia in bilateral trade agreements with the U.S., and my fear is that Trump is living in a kind of a 1980s time warp, where he somehow thinks the U.S. has a lot more leverage than it does. You know, 25 years ago, U.S. trade was about 25 to 30% of the total. Now it's 13%. So you tell me where the leverage is and how much of a market relative to other markets at a time when every single country in Asia has China as its largest trading partner, and trade and investment in Asia is increasingly integrated. So I think we're kind of out of step with where the region is going. And in fact, within the region, we have two competing multilateral trade agreements. Abe is pushing the TPP-11, My sense from talking to Koreans is the minute they revise it and put it in effect, Korea will be joining. And on the other hand, you have the RCEP that the Chinese are pushing, which, since it has ASEAN in it, will go extremely slow, if at all. But those are the trends in the region, and the U.S., they're just remarkably tone-deaf to all that. And frankly, I think that Trump's ideas about trade defy any economics, right? The idea is you know, most economists will tell you trade deficits are a function of savings, investment, consumption. If we consume a lot more than we produce, guess what? You're going to have a deficit. And yet Trump is blaming trade agreements for deficits. And, you know, I think that in the case of China, which is about half the U.S. global deficit, he has some points. I think it's not, I don't see the question of being pro or anti-China. I think China has been the number one beneficiary of the rules-based order over the last 30 years. And now they seem to want to revise it, and I find that Xi Jinping's rhetoric absurd, to posture as the champion of globalization while they're shutting down markets, they're preventing investment. And I think the anti-CFIUS legislation is a reflection, not just in the United States, but I'm seeing similar things in Europe and elsewhere, where I think people are... What Trump is talking about, reciprocity, I think he's correct. If we can't invest in Shanghai, they can't invest in Silicon Valley. It's very simple. And I think, you know, a lot of people are hoping that she rethinks some of these policies, but I think the Made in China 2025 and their effort to dominate emerging technologies is being viewed widely as a kind of a dangerous approach and not consistent with the kind of globalization that made China successful so far.
So I think that's the right point for Wang Shu from the embassy. Maybe you want to, you know, either you want to talk about something or you want to respond to what Bob said. Is China serious about revising the international order, the rule-based international order, or China is actually, as President Xi said at the 19th Party Congress, you know, we benefited from globalization. We're going to contribute to globalization, right? We're going to defend this global order. So,
yes, I'm from the Chinese embassy and policy planning section. And actually, my English is quite poor, so I speak very briefly and let my colleague, Councillor Zhang, talk about our official position. I think the Asia trip is very interesting, very impressive, and I think there's some. My interest is in Obama administration, there was the Asia rebalance. But I think President Trump have the different view about Asia. I think some people maybe have the interest about the geopolitical rebalance and the world economic rebalance. Because there's a very large deficit between China and the U.S. So what is the geopolitical rebalance and what is the world the economic rebalance? Because in the last month, in the 19th the Congress of the China Communist Party, I think the President Xi showed a very strong intention to promote the further and the deeper the economic reform, structural reform, and opening up. I think this is the China, this is the direction of the China future. So maybe we can think about the treaty issue in the structure changing the world and China. So I think it is one of the topic about the Asia trip, and the next is I think is North Korea. North Korea is the dialogue and the pressure. I think during this trip, Trump and especially the Japanese Premier Abe, the push the extreme pressure under North Korea. But for China, we think it's time to the dialogue. So how to think this issue? But I think the trip is very interesting. So I very I need to learn from the everybody. So I think it's a very good opportunity for me. So let my colleague, Councillor Zhang, will talk the details.
We'll just go around the table.
Thank you very much.
So I guess it's Dr. Wong. So really, China said it's going to be dialogue on North Korea. So maybe Dr. Hong can respond to that. You know, I don't. If President Xi told President Trump, saying, "Oh yeah, you know, still we're going to have dialogue." Everybody knows Six Party is dead. Dialogue is dead. China has to ratchet up the pressure, and Minister Song Tao is going.
Well, I think China's position is still, and this is in the UN Security Council right. resolution, calling on the 2005 agreement as the basis for moving forward and resuming Six Party talks. And when I, as far as I understand it, that's China's position.
North Korea has long time said they're never ever going to return to Six Party. You know, Chinese have a very good understanding where things are, and so.
Yeah, I think I'm going to skip over this particular question and leave it for the people who follow very closely on this issue. My general point about this, like whether China is more open for a dialogue on the DPRK, for me, it's very uncertain at this moment. But I'd like to start with two points. One is a general observation on Trump's visit to Asia, and the other is on the most recent one on the South China Sea, which I think is quite profound. So my general observation is very echoed to what Dr. Liu mentioned in the beginning. If I compare how China react to Trump's visit to Asia, especially its visit in China, and how the U.S. politicians and also think tank, it's quite different. When I look at the Chinese media, social media, and also the official media, it's very positive. Most of the reports are very positive, very encouraging, and we see a bright picture for the future China-U.S. engagement. And then, but for the Chinese scholar, they are more, they are more balanced. So many of them agree that there's a very good discussion in terms of the personal relations, but they also tend to agree on the fact that it's a long way to go, given uncertainty of Trump's lack of clarification on its Asia strategy and China policy. But when I, as you mentioned, it's very interesting. I also heard about this Senator John Cornyn's remark and the CSIS on the China Power the annual conference. It's made it very clear China is a threat, not even on the military, but also in economic and technological innovation, etc. All the mentioning actually consider China as a threat. And there was yesterday also Susan Rice wrote in the New York Times, basically is mentioning Trump's making China great again instead of making America great again. So you see how sharp are the difference. So if I can try to summarize how the U.S. look at Trump's visit to Asia. Basically, they are talking, for instance, Trump's being deceived by the high standard, you know, protocol receiving China and other countries. And the second observation, many of like questioning this day, $20-50 billion is not really like a contract, it's only the MOU without any like binding force. And the third observation on how the American look at Trump's visit, they basically thinking, well, China's gained more status in terms of global leadership because of Trump's lack of commitment to Asia. This is my general observation on these issues. And the second point I want to talk about the South China Sea, it's very China, and it's very interesting to look at for us. Mr. Xi Jinping in his 90th Party Congress talk about the South China Sea, especially on this land reclamation and facility as something like domestic efforts. But then you see like Tillerson made this comment and the CSIS like bringing forward a concept of Indo-Pacific and talking about China is not helpful in the South China Sea. You see how they view these issues. But And then Mr. Trump's often to be the mediator when he met with the Vietnamese leadership, mediator in the South China Sea, which I don't think he received very positive reaction from either Vietnam or Singapore or Philippines. But it's very fortunate that we see a lot of progress, especially when Mr. Li Keqiang, our prime minister, met with the ASEAN 10 member in the 20th China-ASEAN meeting. They made a very good suggestion that all China and ASEAN agreed that it's the time that we agree to negotiate the text itself. It's quite a big step because a lot of people are questioning whether it's China's strategy to delay this process of negotiation, but we see that gradually, step by step, we are seeing a lot of progress. So we're done with the framework, and then we're done with like, all the countries agreed to negotiate. Now is the right time, and that's all these countries agreed that we already the negotiation on the text itself has it's going to be happen very soon. So I think it's a very good perspective. So I'm going to leave it for further follow up on the South China Sea.
Sure. So we're moving you to you, Saurabh. You want to talk a little bit more about the Indian Pacific concept, or you know, it's one of the six, and it's you know. Particularly in the context of Secretary Tillerson's speech at CSIS in September, when the first time he went to China, he used the Chinese terminology. And then in the September speech, before he went to India, he was literally talking about, India is democracy, U.S. is a democracy, China is not. So our relationship with China is always on very shaky foundation. So
sure. I'll get to it. Okay, Saurabh Gupta from Institute for China America Studies. Let me be just for a little while a devil's advocate out here and actually give Trump a little bit of credit for the aspects of this trip. First of all, the two areas where I still think he has really hurt U.S. interests is in his tweeting and his personal insults with Kim, which has taken the Korean Peninsula issue that much closer to decision point, whatever decision point that be. And the second issue is unequivocally his comment at APEC CEO summit that U.S. will not be part of a multilateral trade deal or a large agreement has really, really hurt American interests for a long, long time. That having been said, let me make a few points. Trump, I thought, he has, across the world, there have been a lot of criticisms against him. I think he has given Asia at least a fair shake and given and tried to put his personal best foot forward in terms of his trip. Not just his trip, it is unusual how many Asian leaders and Southeast Asian leaders he has invited and met in his very first year in the White House, in the Oval Office. Singapore, Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, all of them have gone through the White House. And so it's a good thing that even, he came into office saying alliance partners need to bear much further greater burden. And that obviously opened the question as to those parties with whom are partners but are not allies. What is the state of how is U.S. committed to these countries? People like Vietnam, who are not allies and really depend on U.S. firm, at least verbal commitment to the region. From that perspective, I think Trump does deserve credit in backing away from his from his earlier campaign positions and showing that he is on board the main alliances that the U.S. has in the region. And that he wants to and is willing and wants to stay engaged diplomatically with the region. I cannot say that with any other region of the world. I think Latin America and Africa, there have been no Trump presence whatsoever out there. And in Europe, obviously, they have not treated them well. He's not treated them well. It's a very mixed bag in terms of that relationship. Comparatively, Asia has done well, I would say, given what we thought Trump was coming in with. Secondly, on the U.S.-China relations, I think it's very important that Trump and Xi Jinping, who are both strong-willed characters, manage to hit it off well, simply because there are a lot of tension points in the relationship, particularly on the economic and trade angle, which I think will really come to the fore next year. I think next year is going to be a very hot year and a difficult year for trade relations. But if the two leaders at the top can try to maintain it at some sort of an even keel, it really helps. And because for China, China is a very powerful country, but the one country which is more powerful than China is the United States, and therefore Xi Jinping has a reason to hold Trump as close as possible to him and ensure that this relationship proceeds on a fairly productive basis. And because Trump came in with strong statements on North Korea and strong statements on trade, I can see Xi Jinping, now that he has gotten so much power, going that much further, trying to do his very best in trying to see how he can meet up to U.S. requests and demands. And that's why it's encouraging also that at the 19th Congress, where he talked about going to the next step of structural reform, I'm really hoping that many of those issues which were captured in the bilateral investment treaty negotiations, one by one by one, that China will deliver on them in that over the next couple of years, and qualitatively open its services and its and many of its markets. So I'm actually hopeful that things could have been a lot worse. But that Trump has shown a commitment to the region, even though on the trade aspect, I mean, there are real questions, and that the Asian leaders do value it, and they're happy to see the American presence there. Finally, on that Indo-Pacific question, India has been obviously very happy because India actually was hoping for a Trump visit, and Trump had enough places to go that he just couldn't come to India. They're happy to be in the conversation, but it's as we saw from the press releases the parties put out in terms at this after the quadrilateral meeting, the parties, India was the one which was the vaguest in terms of talking of something which was not a us versus them formation, but rather something which was more open, inclusive, and could bring everybody in together. So India, among all the other four parties, actually, because it already has a Russia-China dialogue on Asia, as well as a BRICS dialogue, both at the National Security Advisors level and at the foreign ministers level, actually thinks that this might be a good way to balance its relationships in Asia, can have its foot on this side and on that side, and hope that all parties don't actually compete and headbutt against each other, but a basis to kind of have a more cooperative approach to the Asia Pacific. So from that perspective, I think they're happy how it turned out, and they don't necessarily see Asia Pacific going drifting in that zero sum context where, as some people think or and hope that Asia would go towards.
So, thanks. Carter, your assessment, positive, negative, or somewhere in between?
Carla Freeman from Johns Hopkins SAIS. Overall, I think the visit from the White House's perspective went extremely smoothly, and I'm not particularly surprised that the red carpets were rolled out so beautifully for Trump and that he responded so well. And I'm also not surprised that the visit wasn't well received in Washington in policy circles, and indeed across the country, President Trump's approval rating is low. And in any case, most presidents, even when they are more popular, their visits to China are always scrutinized and criticized in Washington. And Washington is not particularly divided on the China question. I think most people in Washington are very concerned about the direction, the political direction that China's headed in. The 19th Party Congress actually signaled to Americans that China was headed in a direction where it was concentrating power, and the power of the party was going to be supreme. And so it isn't surprising that in the wake of a visit in which our president is seen enjoying himself on the red carpet in China, that American pundits would come down hard on the state of U.S.-China relations. I was surprised by Senator Corker's rather harsh take on the U.S.-China relationship in some ways, but I'm not surprised, and I think in other ways, I think that's the direction of language that we're going to hear both from policymaking circles and from the legislature in the future. That said, there are a lot of other actors in the United States that would like to see that have high stakes in a positive U.S.-China relationship. I point to governors, and I think that Ambassador Branstad reflected that perspective, and it's one reason that the visit went so well, in that governors in the United States are eager for Chinese investment, and so that local level push will continue to be a factor in the U.S.-China relationship. But the next year is going to be tough because there wasn't any movement on key issues of concern in the United States in the economic arena. And despite President Trump's talk of reciprocity, there was very little movement in terms of concrete policy outcomes. On the North Korea piece, I think, as someone who would love to see some kind of negotiation result in some kind of stabilization of the situation, I was encouraged that President Trump signaled his willingness to meet with Kim Jong-un, but he also sent confusing messages, as many of you have mentioned, by an ad hominem attack on Kim Jong-un as well in his Twitter feed. I'm really worried about the situation. I'm not sure, since we don't have a coherent policy, many people in Washington misassess, and perhaps Bob Manning can address this further. They don't really have a good handle on what the implications of military action in North Korea. I think they they miscalculate and believe that we could have some kind of limited conflict to take care of the nuclear problem. And I've heard this even from some of my students who are in the military, and it really concerns me. On the Indo-Pacific concept, that is, I think, certainly I think that's directed at India and it's a balancing idea, a way of bringing India in. But I'm not surprised, as Saurabh mentioned, that India is ambivalent about being drawn into this kind of balancing strategy on the part of the United States. And I think it's a concept that we're going to see evolve, and I think it isn't a coherent vision at the moment. And among the other six points, the South China Sea, that issue is going to come up again, and it is a positive development that the region is addressing a Bill of Rights for this, you know, sort of crafting a Bill of Rights for this issue. But I think that at some point there's going to be that this issue will emerge again as a major source of conflict between the United States, or tension between the United States and China. I think the Chinese, they're poised, they're in a position to try to manage everything and to try to minimize tensions in the region. They have a very, very challenging domestic agenda to address, would like to see the region stay stable, but I don't think the United States is going to cooperate.
Thanks, Carla. So, Yan, official position from the Chinese government, as Shu mentioned.
Thank you, Director Liu. We'd like to thank Dr. Hongno and ICAS to organize such a high-level seminar and invite us to join. We come here not for the policy briefing, not standing for the official policy. We come here to listen and exchange views with you, privileged the professors and scholars, to share views on so many important issues in Asia-Pacific and China-U.S. relations. So first, as to the North Korea issue, I think, of course, Director Liu and Professor Manning has mentioned how to see the North Korean peninsula. As Carla has said, it seems that from American side, we personally, no, that is totally my personal understanding. It seems there's no coherent message. It's always many fluctuations and many changes. So this is an issue. The leftover of the Cold War, that is such a complicated issue with so many historical contact and so many geopolitical implications there. So we need to have the policy of within a comprehensive framework. So from Chinese official policy has been adhering to three aspects. First one is denuclearization of North Korea, of Korean Peninsula. The second is the keeping the peace and stability of the peninsula. The third is this issue should have the resolution based on dialogue and negotiation. So that should be regarded in a comprehensive way instead of just picking something out. So when President Xi and President Trump met in Beijing, President Xi reiterated China's position on the denuclearization of the peninsula and also proposed that all the parties concerned need to cooperate for the long-lasting peace and stability of the peninsula and the East, Northeast Asia. So that will be, since that is a complicated issue, so we need a long view, we need a comprehensive framework to regard this issue and try to find some resolution, reasonable, and that's possible for a long-lasting resolution in the future. So we think that is such a big issue, so we need the big picture, and it seems that we'll take some long time. But we need to judge the current situation as well as looking at the future. So maybe just like we need to think about the specific issues with the regional issue, I think when we talk about China and China's relation with the U.S. and China's relation with the outside world, we need to take a comprehensive view. So personally, I think as to the current situation of China and China's relation with the outside world, we need to pay attention to three points. The first point is about the direction. I know that there are so many privileged scholars here, and I think everyone present here should be quite well informed about the 19th National Congress of Chinese Communist Party. I'd like to share my views about how to see China's direction after this important Congress. First, about the direction. That's China has made it clear that China will try to become a great modernist socialist country by the middle of this century. And the direction of this country is that we need to exert all the efforts to realize the Chinese dream of national rejuvenization. This national rejuvenization especially includes the well-being of Chinese people and the development of the country. So, because of we have such overarching goal, so we need to guarantee a favorable external environment to help us to achieve such a great goal. So so China's relation with the outside world has always been try to find a reasonable road that is the peaceful development. So, because of China, because China now is the second largest economy, and because China is gaining more significance in the world, so there are many scholars that have so many reviews, so many views on China's future. So I think we, if we make a specific focus on the long-time direction of China, judged by the Chinese Communist Party, and we should have the confidence that that is something predictable. Not like some people have the concern that maybe there's some uncertainties or maybe it's some unpredictable changes. At least we should have the strategic confidence that the direction for China is clear. And the direction for the relationship between China and the other countries are also clear. So that is the issue of direction. Based on this issue, we should say that how to achieve this direction. So China has made clear that we need to adhere to our national policy of reform and opening up. So some differences on China, if China is still opening up, if China's market access have any problems. There are so many arguments about that. But from Chinese side, we have made the national policy as the opening up, and President Xi also reiterated this policy many times, including when he attended the business the business meeting with President Trump, and he reiterated that the only possible choice for China's development is opening up. So I think that is the road to the direction. So the third point, I think that is the approach. So what's the mentality of realizing the goal and take the path? Just as Dr. Hong has mentioned that the zero-sum mentality has been outdated. So we need to find some new way in such a faster changing world. So China has proposed to construct the major power diplomacy with the Chinese characteristic in the new era. So maybe I think the rhetoric seems a little complicated. I think the main part of this diplomacy can be drawn into two paths. One is the community of shared future for mankind. That is the Chinese resolution to where the world, where the humankind should head for. Because the world has changed so fast, there are so many complicated issues, so many different differences. And someone supports globalization, someone anti-globalization, there are so many views. So what is the reasonable future of the humankind? We think that can only be the community of the mankind. And another part of Chinese new diplomacy is about the new type of international relations. That has been put a couple of years earlier, and now that has been made a definition that this new type of international relations should have the future as mutual respect. This is the first. The second is the fairness and justice. The third is the win-win cooperation. I think maybe some concepts, if someone listens to the concept, it seems so idealistic. But at such a faster changing world, we need to have a clear of a far-reaching goal, and that will be a reasonable direction, both for single country and for the world. So with all these thinking that, you know, maybe that's my own personal understanding of Chinese policy. And this Chinese policy has developed into China's communication with, you know, with the U.S. and the world. Sorry, maybe I have took too much time. Just one word. President Xi have praised President Trump's visit to China has historic significance. And there has been a blueprint and the roadmap from the states of the heads of states level, and also have with the support of the four level dialogues. The China-U.S. relationship has now has a clear road and a solid foundation. Maybe the time has been spent.
We'll come back to you at a later time.
Thank you.
So I guess Huang Jing can talk whatever you want, but one question I want you maybe to respond to her is, how do you operationalize a diplomacy of fairness and justice, the community of common destiny? This new type, I think Ambassador Cui last night said the same thing, new type of international relationship that you just defined. For many who are watching this, is how do you operationalize it? There's a cool in Zimbabwe, mutual respect. What are you going to say? We're not going to do anything there, or we respect the decision of the Zimbabwe military, or as some suggested, China is behind it, because there's a lot of Chinese interest. And the defense minister of Zimbabwe happened to visit China, a few days ago. And so when you have what is happening on the ground, and then you have this lofty rhetoric on new type of international relations, so it's just hard to reconcile.
Yeah, to answer your question, I think about this, whatever you call it, big community with common destiny or whatever, we have to understand that when you talk with people, if you want other people to agree with you, you have to agree upon the definition of the issue you talk about. So China defines this community or community with us way, but if Chinese cannot convince the other side to accept this definition, you never have any agreement, not even by China, okay? Because the definition is so different. And the second, you have to understand in whose term this thing can be achieved, in your term or in other people's term, in the comparison term. I think that our Chinese friends should understand, if the outside world cannot accept the very definition of the term you talk about, you never achieve what you want. Your definition is quite different. And if other people think accept your definition means we're going to achieve this thing in your term, they'll never go against, go with you. So I think that more is about explanation, kind of definition that can be accepted by others. That's a minimum. And talk about, let's go back to Donald Trump's visit. I think that a presidential visit like this from the number one power to number two power is always more symbolic rather than substantial. Of course, there's not much substance to talk about in the first place, like he just said. So let's talk about symbolic. And symbolically, this is a very bad visit for the United States. First, I make three simple points to show my what I mean. First, like Susan Rice said very clearly, that it's China that occupies the central stage for the visit. In my memory, it's the first time that the President of the United States with a long visit, such a high-profile visit to Asia-Pacific, is treated as a guest, truly guest. It's not like we are also a country of Pacific. Not at all. Donald Trump is always treated as a guest, even though he's treated like a king for the summit. He's a guest. This is my term, this is my turf, this is my place. You come here, you work with me. That's China's approach. And like we just said, China got it. But he's not playing a central stage role. It's not because United States is not powerful. It's not even because Donald Trump is a weak person, he's a strong person. It's because the message he sent to Asia Pacific is totally wrong. Politically, the message is American first, unilateralism. Economically, is mercantilism. But in this region, countries there want a multilateral arrangement centered on US alliance system, economically and politically. We did not see that. And second, there's no comprehensive and consistent policy framework at all for such a high-profile visit. What is US policy towards Asia-Pacific? He did not even mention Asia-Pacific, but mention an empty shell called Indo-Pacific,
which not Indian would fully agree in terms of substance. So because of that, people in that region did not see a clear commitment and credibility of United States, especially U.S. presidency, especially he is so unpredictable. No commitment, no credibility, no predictability. And so that's why this visit is. That's my first point. The center stage is lost because the message is wrong, because the role he plays is wrong, and that's because he did not have a clear policy. And the second point I make is that China, through this visit, China showed to the whole world that U.S.-China relations can be managed. It's stable, at least it's workable. Why? Because Donald Trump can be managed. Of course, this is the first president U.S. have, or we have, that needs to be managed. But I think China managed him better than Washington, D.C. So that message is very clear. And also, the most damaging visit by Donald Trump is that China can achieve its strategic goals through overhead diplomacy. That is, for the countries around China, no matter how you stand up against China, if I work with your big brother, United States, if we can strike a deal, you guys are granted. And that is why, the Philippines, Vietnamese, Malaysia, Singapore, even Japan, South Korea, they all turn to go to China because they know they cannot count on United States. They cannot count on President Donald Trump. So that message is very damaging because the overhead diplomacy is a good tool if you use correctly, but this time used very badly. China used it very well. The third point I want to make on this is that for such a high-profile visit, after Donald Trump was in office for over 150 days, China is much better prepared than United States. President Xi Jinping is much better prepared than President Donald Trump. So therefore, China, even though China overall is still weaker than the United States, but China is in a much better position in dealing with the summit. That tells, I think, that goes to the 19th Party Congress, that China as a major power internally is more integrated, more stable, and more consolidated. Compared to the United States, everybody can say it's a very messy situation at best. It's internally a lot of strifes and not very consolidated as China. So therefore, that balanced out the U.S. strength over China because of internal problems. Of course, Donald Trump is a major factor for all those internal problems. So that's what I have to say. But down the road, I want to say a few words about down the road. I would caution my Chinese friends, don't be too jubilant about this successful visit of President Donald Trump. Of course, U.S.-China relationship can already benefited from Donald Trump's visit. But down the road, I think it will suffer more maybe from the backlash of U.S. political mainstream. I think Chinese friends have to be very careful about this. The backlash could be very strong, very hard, and very lasting. Just look, right, even before Donald Trump left Asia, there's a three battle groups in that region. It's not to put pressure on North Korea. Tiny little North Korea doesn't need three battle groups. It's a show of strength of United States. We're still here. The president is very strong. And that message has to be correctly and rightfully accepted. Although the business circle may have a positive response to Donald Trump's visit, but that response is very limited because it's mostly MOUs. It's not really a deal. If you look at Wall Street reflection, it's very limited, even negative. And that's my first point. Second, I also want to caution friends from China that there might be an increase after Donald Trump visit. Ironically, we have an increased anxiety of countries around China about China's rise, perhaps to the dominance. India, Japan, all the so-called substantial countries, I'm not talking about Singapore or Brunei, I'm talking about countries have carried some weight. Japan, India, even Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, for example, or even Russia. They're going to say, oh, if United States leave too quickly, maybe we should work on our own to manage China. I always tell my Chinese friend to remember Germany's lesson. Germany tried to get up twice. Look what happened. The British and the French work together, even though they don't like each other at all, to put it down. So if maybe this is a huge if United States left, leave right now, trust me, Indians, Japanese, even Russians, Vietnamese will all work together. Even though China does not want to play its own political game, but other countries do. So therefore, this kind of increasing anxiety about China's rise could have two results. Result number one, countries around China will work with China, just like Philippines, Vietnam, and other countries. But there is another possibility. They could work together against China. I've been to, for example, in October, I've been to a World Club conference. I just had a China-Indian track to dialogue in Chengdu. I went to Germany just last month. The message I got there is more anxiety rather than appreciation. So I think that if China really want to open up, I believe open up reform is a future for China. And I think open up also means should open up the eyes and ears and minds to listen to the voice around China, to not be this, you know, overwhelmed by its this great success, because like Chinese said, when you have a great success, also you sow the seeds for next crisis. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. So, Catherine, more North Korea, because Paul shared work on that front.
Yes, so this is Catherine Killo, Plasher's Fund. I would like to preface with I am by no means an expert on China. My concentration is on the Korean Peninsula, so my knowledge of China is filtered through that lens. So I will probably be speaking the least and listening a lot. What I would like to contribute, though, on the North Korea subject is that I think a lot of us saw Trump's trip to South Korea as a missed opportunity. And yes, he passed a low bar, he stayed on script, but I would push back on what a lot of people have latched onto and praised, not necessarily here, but among the sort of Washington foreign policy establishment, is that he's signaled an openness or willingness to talk. I think that's not at all true. During his speech, he misrepresented the negotiation record. He has, in multiple instances, characterized North Korea as just a bad negotiator, unreliable. I think in one of his tweets, he actually rejected all negotiations in the past and said that only one thing will work, and that one thing sounds like a military option. And this idea of preventive war, of the U.S. striking North Korea's nuclear facilities first, is gaining traction, even among Democrats, I think. It seems to me that the Trump administration is pushing this sort of false binary choice right now, where it's either we act now on North Korea or we allow it to engage in nuclear blackmail. So there's this sort of like immediacy with regard to North Korea that the Trump administration is pushing, and I think it's dangerous. So I would ask that we maybe reframe some of the questions here instead of trying to guess, you know, will the harder line prevail or more conciliatory approach. I think we need, well, what I would be interested in hearing is how do we actually promote a diplomatic or conciliatory approach. So what would that look like on the China side? What would they want to see happen in a dialogue? What would they be willing to offer? What are China's insecurities related to a U.S.-North Korea crisis? And then what can the U.S. do to provide assurances to China on that? So, thank you.
Okay. Will, which part of the six questions you're going to respond?
Catherine, my background is mostly on nuclear weapons policy. So I'm going to address the DPRK issue, but also a little bit about the South China Seas. So I think echoing what Dr. Manning and Carla Freeman said, I really do think that the overall implications for the Asia trip were really bad for American national security. Trump gave this speech to the South Korean parliament where he oddly received a lot of praise in the press. People thought he was being presidential. That's a pretty, as Catherine said, that's a pretty low bar for just managing to read a teleprompter and stick on script. But then he sends this next mixed message days later that the United States is never going to sign a regional trade agreement ever again. TPP is dead. Forget about any regional trade. You have to deal with us directly. So on the one hand, he's sending a message of unity, right? Like kind of echoing back to the Cold War. The international community needs to be strong and steadfast against this threat. And then he's sending a message days later of disunity. The United States kind of lives in its own club, and we don't really need you all that much. That's pretty confusing to most powers in Asia. The third thing about mixed messages is, just days later, after he's given this good speech, relatively good speech, right, according to the teleprompter, about unity, he sends out a tweet where he says, you know, why would Kim Jong-un call me old and fat, old and senile? right, exactly. Yeah, he sends out this message, and, I'm fairly active on Twitter, and I'm seeing every single person in the American foreign policy community going, like, what is this? And the fact is, what's really scary about Trump's tweets, they mean more than speeches. They mean more than policy. Because every single leader in the world knows that's scripted. That's been thought out by somebody else. That's a direct insight into how his mind works. And that tells everybody that he cannot be trusted. So that's very concerning. So kind of building on this, the rhetoric that is going back and forth between North Korea and the United States now for months, it's troubling. And I really don't see this getting any better. The solution that we like to talk about in DC policy circles is, you know, China's going to fix our problem. And since they'll ramp up pressure, they have to ramp up pressure. But I think the fundamental problem is that Chinese interests and American interests do not align on North Korea. Now, both the United States and China share the ultimate goal of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That's important for them. It's important for us. It's important for Russia. It's important for everyone that the NPT be upheld. But in the way that we get to that goal, we see it very differently. The United States thinks that the North Korean regime should be pressured to the point where it can collapse. In fact, we want it to collapse, right? Like, regime change would be good for the United States. That is not the case for China. That would be the worst scenario possible for China, even more so than a Korea with nuclear weapons on it. And Americans don't seem to understand that. And until you can find a way to navigate that divide and to come to an agreement, you're never going to see China put the kind of pressure that the United States wants. Because frankly, by putting the pressure on North Korea that we are asking them to do, you're risking collapse. Therefore, they are risking a unified Korean Peninsula on South Korean terms, which basically means American troops right on South Korea's on their border, which I have a feeling they would find completely unacceptable. So, how to navigate that divide? I don't really know, but I certainly didn't see any results that indicate that is happening from coming out of this Asia trip. You know, I saw Trump saying that. His relationship with Xi Jinping is great. It's the best relationship in the world. But I don't see any evidence to back that up. So shifting track a little bit from North Korea now to the issue of the South China Sea. Again, I didn't really see any tangible products on how to resolve that issue. We both agree that it's a problem. but how are you going to move ahead resolving that problem? That's a difficult question, but I think that the number one pressing issue in the South China Sea is that the United States, China, and other regional players need to develop better escalation control mechanisms. Graham Allison had an article in the National Interest a couple months ago now, called Destined for War, and this was based off of his book by the same title, where he laid out a scenario where a U.S. destroyer conducts a phone up near Fiery Reef, gets harassed by Chinese Coast Guard vessels, and this has actually happened before. This was based on a scenario that's actually played out. But he said, while they're doing this, this kind of standoff is happening, the destroyer fails to turn in time, rams one of the Chinese Coast Guard vessels, it sinks, all hands on deck, drown. They die. Essentially, it's a longer story, but he paints a picture where something small like that could escalate into a full-scale war with an aircraft carrier being sunk, and what happens next. The lesson that he was trying to get to is that you need mechanisms in place to ensure that that cannot happen. Communication channels, military to military. Right now we have some, but I think it needs to be more robust. Rather than the leadership to leadership level of communication or even commander to commander, it needs to be ship to ship and air to air, and then air to ship. And then you also have this complicating factor of Chinese militia vessels. So signals that even if a signal goes, you know, a message is sent from a United States Navy ship to the Chinese Navy or even the Chinese Coast Guard, if they're left out of the loop, you still have that cycle of escalation that could happen. So to kind of rehash, I didn't really see anything addressing these issues. And I think that's problematic. I think it made America look weak. And I really hope that we can roll some of this back. But I do not foresee that being possible in the next 3 years.
So maybe does Brookings have a shared view on this, or Thompson Center has one and your center has another?
Well, I'm certainly not speaking on behalf of Brookings as a whole, but I'm Maeve Weiss, and I'm in the Center for East Asia Policy Studies at Brookings. I think I'm going to talk a bit more on cross-strait relations and U.S.-Taiwan relations, and in this past trip, that didn't come up, which I think is for the best. I think, you know, where we are with cross-strait relations in the Trump administration thus far, because it sort of started off, it was a rocky start, and so at this point, sort of no news or no news directly from Trump can kind of be interpreted as good enough news. But looking at where cross-strait relations are following the 19th Party Congress, and sort of now that Xi Jinping, you know, sort of consolidated much more power, because a lot of people leading up in Taiwan, a lot of people leading up to the 19th Party Congress were sort of taking a wait-and-see approach and sort of see what happens, and then we can reassess. So I think at this point, it looks like the cross-strait relationship is sort of at an impasse, and it will likely sort of stay that way for a bit because you have Tsai Ing-wen, she's gone as far as she can in terms of what she can say in terms of the 1992 consensus, but that is not as far as Xi Jinping and Beijing wants her to go. But she can't do it for domestic reasons because of, you know, she was elected, you know, as a Green candidate, she has enough forces pulling her away from going any further. And I don't think she necessarily wants to go further. You know, she wants to protect Taiwan, Taiwan's security and its own interests. But with that said, Beijing is sort of, even though there's, you know, they've cut off communication channels and there's not a lot happening between Taiwan and China, Beijing's making moves slowly, sort of within the international community. You're seeing, you know, for instance, the switching of diplomatic relations. We saw Panama switch this past summer. Last year, Sao Tome, and there's even sort of level below that. You have different Taiwan representative offices in other countries who are sort of changing names, moving locations, and that's all sort of part of this greater effort. by China to chip away at Taiwan's position within the international space. So I think that will continue to happen despite no communications across the strait. You know, Beijing ultimately is being patient and isn't going to pursue, it won't change its position in terms of Tsai Ing-wen, because I think they're still hoping that the KMT can eventually recover and try to come back to power by 2020. You know, sort of this has happened before in 2000 when Chen Shui-bian and the DPP came to power, even though relations definitely didn't, you know, declined during the Chen administration. Eventually, Ma Ying-jeou won and the KMT came back to power. So I think Beijing is part of people in Beijing who think, well, if we just wait it out, we'll get back to what we want. But I think it's too early to tell. You know, right now the KMT is not in, you know, I don't think it's completely dead, but they have a long way to go. And I think the first test will be next year's 2018 local elections, and that'll sort of give a pulse on where Taiwan is domestically, and then that will sort of indicate potentially whether this stalemate will continue and for how long. And then one other issue I wanted to talk about too is looking at sort of the other regional actors in after Trump's visit. So you see, you know, I sort of think that Japan won Trump's visit in a way, because you have Abe and Trump, you know, they have a very strong relationship, and that continued on. And then you saw Japan taking more leadership role in terms of the new TPP, the CPTPP, and then also with the renewal of the quadrilateral dialogue, you are seeing Japan taking a larger role within the regional relations. And again, just like Xi Jinping did in the 19th Party Congress, we just saw Shinzo Abe come off of a really a big electoral victory. So he's sticking around for a bit. And then I think it'll be interesting to watch what happens with the South Korea-China thaw that's sort of happening. You know, you saw Moon Jae-in and Xi Jinping meet in the sides of APEC, and it looks like Moon might travel to China relatively soon. Maybe Xi will go to the Olympics in February. So I think that's something to watch, and sort of, you know, looking at the two outlines that that Dr. Huang laid out, was that you could have countries work together or work with China, and I sort of see Japan as going both routes, right? They're, because Shinzo Abe and Xi Jinping also met on the sidelines of APEC, and so you're seeing they hailed a fresh start in China-Japan relations. So it'll be interesting to me to sort of monitor how Japan and South Korea, how they proceed with their relations with Beijing.
All right, Bob, so you have the advantage of, you know, having seen all the cards on the table, right?
It looks like I have 40 minutes, the whole floor. Yeah, that's right. No, I know that this is Bob Sutter from George Washington University. I know this is probably going to be my only time to say something, so I just wanted, I've been trying to think about what I would say about this. First, a couple of points. I agree with most of the positive things that have been said about the Donald Trump visit. It really did some important things. I'm watching for the building up of a strategy in the United States to deal with the Asia Pacific. Obviously, the United States administration doesn't have one yet. It's very conflicted on economic issues. There is a military strategy. DOD has been working on this for a long time. They're implementing it. It's a very clear strategy. The allies are probably not very worried about being undermined in any particular way at this point, and they're going to have more money soon. There is a strategy on human rights and democracy. Put it aside. I'm not sure that's a negative in Asia. It may work fairly well in Asia. So the big problem is the economic dimension, which has been discussed here. So, and we're still in that uncertain period, and we don't have a clear strategy. And second point, I agree that there are tensions, lots of tensions in U.S.-China relations. That started off our discussion. Where do these senators get these views? Why do they think like this? This is something I've spent a lot of time looking at, trying to understand the dynamics domestically as well as in foreign affairs that drive American policy toward China. And this is the framework that I use to explain this.
Nixon and Mao brought these two countries together. They were extremely different, but it worked because they were opposed to the Soviet Union. And they stuck together, great difficulties, various times, until 1989, until Tiananmen and the end of the Cold War, and ultimately the end of the Soviet Union. At that time, the United States basically tore up the framework. They just tore it up. And they went after it, the Chinese leadership. Now, George H.W. Bush didn't do this, but the country did as a whole, the Congress, the media, it was obvious. Since that time, keep in mind, we've been trying to create a new framework. Our colleagues from the Chinese embassy are looking for frameworks. And various ones have been proposed, and they all failed. The latest one we're dealing with is the new type of great power relationship. That has failed. Doesn't work, particularly from the U.S. side. And so I can go through the details of this, but basically I think you're all familiar with this situation. We don't have a framework. And so that works between us. And why is that? There are some very basic reasons why that is. Number one, we have very big issues with one another, differences, very big ones. And these haven't been resolved in any way, in any significant way. They manage them, but they're not resolved. And sometimes they rise to great prominence. Secondly, we're both big powers. Big powers don't change easily. Nobody's going to push them around. And so they're going to stick to their positions. And the third thing is, both powers are very exceptional. They both think of themselves as right, and often they're very self-absorbed. For my Chinese friends, I want to say, the Chinese Communist Party 19th Congress on Foreign Policy emphasized that to this observer to a great extreme. Extremely self-absorbed and extremely self-righteous. And so this idea of somehow paying attention to what the neighbors think, what others who will be impacted by this rise of a new China, the leading power of Asia, big power in the world, what's going to happen to them? That's not addressed in the discourse on Xi Jinping's vision in foreign affairs. Why? Because it's all about China. That's why. And so this is a big problem, I think. Now, in the United States, where are we coming from in dealing with China? Well, we've gone through these various phases. Mr. Obama felt he wasn't getting enough respect from the Chinese, so he came up with a rebalance policy, which helped him deal with China. And the Chinese saw that as a danger, and the Chinese reacted to that in various ways. And we find mainly the recent period we're in is the strong man, Xi Jinping, pursuing a very assertive foreign policy vis-a-vis the neighbors who are allies and friends of the United States. The U.S. position in the United States is undermined in Asia. Economic policies are pursued. Domestic policies of coercion, of control are pursued. And this all leads to conclusions in the United States over the last couple of years by elites, by Republicans and Democrats, widespread in the Congress, and widespread among Democrats and Republicans. And they all say what? Engagement hasn't worked. They're going in the wrong direction, and Xi Jinping at the Party Congress has just emphasized, I'm continuing this direction. He's adding to it. And so America and Japan and Vietnam, get used to it. This is the new normal. This is a new era that you have to get used to. Well, they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. And so what I see is then there's going to be more tension in the relationship. There's going to be resistance in the relationship. You're going to find it all over. The Japanese are resisting. The Indians will resist. The Vietnamese will resist in their own ways. These others will hedge. And they'll look to the United States for help, and DOD is there. DOD will be there. Now, whether the other parts of the country are there, whether the trade representatives are there, I'm not sure. But I think strategically, it's there. It'll be stronger. And so that's tension. Now, I want to compound this somewhat gloomy picture, but I'm sort of wearing a dark tie today. And
somewhat gloomy. Not a bright, shiny red tie.
Compounding this is that we have a totally new type of leader. And so the Chinese, and so the idea of the Chinese saying that they have Mr. Trump under control, I had to almost laugh. I did lots of interviews in China in the middle of 2016. And talked to various Chinese, and they all said, oh, we can figure, Trump is easy to deal with, and so forth. And then, he wasn't even president, and he takes this call from Tsai Ing-wen, he questions the One China policy. He shows how unpredictable he is. He is avowedly unpredictable. This is just the opposite of Barack Obama. When the Chinese pressed in all these different areas, finally, Mr. Obama reacted publicly to the Chinese. For 6 years, he hardly said anything negative about China. Then for 2 years, he was very vocal about this. So you pushed good old even-handed Obama over the edge. And so, but yet, when he acted, he was always very deliberative, very transparent, very iterative, no drama Obama. Remember that? You know, he didn't want that. And he didn't talk about it. So no high-level tension. Donald Trump is avowedly unpredictable. So if you think you have a fix on Donald Trump, just ask Hillary Clinton. It doesn't work. And because he just moves around. And he's very dramatic. He's very vocal. He's constantly talking about very sensitive issues at a very high level. And this is just the opposite of what Obama does. And this causes tension. And he likes tension. This guy wasn't supposed to be president. I guess you all know that. He was not supposed to. He won because he created tension, and then he used it to his advantage. And he won the presidency on that basis. And so when I'm looking out, I say we're in a phase where Americans are looking to push back against China in a variety of ways, as the senator did in the session that you mentioned. And that's Republicans and Democrats. And we have a president who just loves tension. So I predict, whoever's listening to this, I predict, get ready, there's going to be more tension. Thank you.
All right, so we have 30 minutes. I think Bob provided us, you know, if there's no framework between US and China, there is a framework now for our next stage of the discussion is what is going to be the framework. You know, if that framework is absent, then it is trouble, as we heard from the two Bobs. You know, I would propose maybe North Korea nuclear crisis is the framework, you know, even though it's not a big one, but I think U.S. China, if they can work together on this, that's going to be beneficial, mutually beneficial, because this is, I think, it is for community of shared destiny, because we don't want to see a nuclear war. You know, both China and the U.S. agree that it is going to be a denuclearized North Korea. Although in China, I've heard scholars like Da Wei saying, you know, there's nothing we can do to stop it. You know, we just have to recognize that North Korea, like India and Pakistan, is going to be a nuclear power. And at the CFR on Tuesday, I heard among all the Washington elite saying we should allow Japan to nuclearize. Because if South North Korea has that, you know, what are you going to do? The second thing I want to say, then, you know, I think all of you can start, is you look at the People's 19th Party Congress. So people draw three conclusions. Number one is on the politics that Carla mentioned, is that this return, you know, to the communist orthodoxy. You know, what exactly does that mean? You know, she took the whole standing committee to the where the party was founded in 1921 and then to the boat. Now, on the economic forum, I think Yan Zhang said very well, you know, we're going to continue to deepen and expand the reform, although it's not clear exactly where, because we had the third plenum of the 18th Party Congress, huge blueprint for economic reform, which really didn't happen then. And lastly, on the foreign policy area, basically, I think a lot of people say there's a lot of space to move around, including, you know, U.S.-China collaboration. So I think we can ask each other questions, or you want to reject some others' hypotheses or predictions. And
I don't have much to add. I agree with everything Bob said. I think we're going to see a number of trade measures implemented over the next few months against China. That will be the first thing. On North Korea, I'm very concerned because you have people that I don't believe understand North Korea very well, and military guys had just lost two wars and they're gearing up for a third. And the notion that once they define a North Korea with an ICBM as an unacceptable threat, then they're setting it up for some kind of military action. Mm-hmm. The problem we have is we don't have any targets. We don't know where North Korea, what tunnels and mountains they've hid these mobile missiles in. We don't know how many nukes they have or where they are. We don't know how many HEU facilities they have or where they are. So I don't understand the logic in dropping bombs, and maybe if you're really lucky you get 15% of their program. In the meantime, they've sent a missile into a Japanese nuclear facility or I mean, it's unbelievably stupid, but we have some pretty unbelievably stupid people making decisions. And so I worry about that, and I also worry about the cavalier way they've seemed to disregard deterrence, which last time I looked has worked pretty well for the last 70 years. And it's odd because everybody agrees that the number one priority for North Korea is regime survival. So why would they start a war? It makes, you know, we don't have mutual assured destruction for North Korea. We have assured destruction. Maybe they could hit a city, and that's the end of North Korea. So it doesn't make much sense to me. And I also think, I guess what I would say is there's a difference between living with a de facto nuclear Korea, keeping sanctions and pressure on the international community, saying we will not accept this, and cutting a deal where you basically give them what they want, which is they want to be Pakistan, they want to be accepted as a normal country with nuclear weapons, with sanctions lifted and everything else. I don't believe that's going to happen. So I'm very worried about the language I'm hearing, not just from Trump, but from his national security advisors and others. And I also think that North Korea is a very important issue in terms of defining the U.S.-China relationship. The economic problem, I don't have an answer to, but I will say, I have to apologize because I have to go, but for years, the strongest pillar of support for the U.S.-China relationship has been the American business community. And if you listen to the American Chamber of Commerce, or the European Chamber of Commerce, they are extremely upset at China's closing off of the markets, even as Xi Jinping says he's opening them. And particularly in key areas of emerging technologies that are going to define the global economy over the next 20 years. And I think China's making a huge mistake. In fact, it's hurting itself, because as the U.S. found out when we were dealing with Japan in the 80s, competition is good. The American auto industry would not be as efficient as it is now if we hadn't had to respond to Japanese competition in the 1980s. And for China, if they want to do AI and robotics and all the rest, the Chinese companies will be more efficient if they can compete globally in an open system. So I think that Xi Jinping is making a mistake. I think he's made a strategic decision to be what I call good enough China, that he'd rather have control and have Chinese industry not be globally competitive, but be one tier below that, but very successful. And I think that's a mistake. And I think you will find a growing. The problem for Donald Trump is he doesn't like things multilateral. And the only way I can see to deal with the Chinese economic situation is to have a common view amongst the U.S., Europe, Japan, and other OECD countries that if China wants to play in globalization, they have to. It's a two-way street. And but I don't see Donald Trump personally. Or don't forget, we have a government that basically exists in name only. Who's going to do it? Who's going to manage the China relationship? You know, I don't see a Hank Paulson out there who can manage a very complex, important relationship. So that's a problem. We don't even have an assistant secretary for East Asia at the State Department. And Rex Tillerson doesn't seem to care a whole lot about it. So I'm pretty pessimistic. I'll stop there. And I want to apologize because I have to get back for a meeting.
Thanks.
Just to follow up on that, so you said China and the United States do not have aligned interest on North Korea. I would say, yes, actually they do. I think North Korea poses a threat not only to the U.S., but also a bigger threat to China. So to follow what Bob just said, you know, the North Korea issue could be a glue that will put this relationship together that is facing a risk of falling apart on other issues.
Yeah. I was just going to add on to Bob raising the issue of preventative war. I agree with everything he said. You know, it's silly. It's beyond, you know, not looking far, right? They hold South Korea hostage with their conventional capabilities, the same with Japan. And we don't know where all their nuclear weapons or facilities are, right? So it almost seems suicidal.
Somewhere very close to the Chinese border.
Right, yeah, exactly. Another really troubling aspect to this, though, that I think has been completely overlooked, almost completely overlooked, I've heard some academics talking about this, is that you know, China is allied with North Korea. And if the United States goes to war with North Korea, that complicates the equation significantly. Like, China could get involved. I'm not saying that they will, but they could. Now, if it was an issue where North Korea attacked South Korea or attacked the United States, I don't think China would do anything. This is just my personal opinion. But that's a factor that I don't think anybody in the American government is really talking about, and I find that very, very concerning.
Yeah, I think that North Korea, unless it doesn't want to leave, and mm-hmm. it will not attack first, and as a dictator is afraid of death, that's a common rule all over the world. But I think that I'm not very pessimistic in the sense that on the North Korean issue, both sides are run out of policy options. Where will North Korea go? I think that his father played a smart game that one foot in, one foot out. That's the best position for North Korea to negotiate. But now the two feet are out, it's a nuclear power. So there's not, in other words, Kim Jong-un is run out of policy options. He basically, you know, timed himself out. But on the other side, United States and China also run out of policy options. That's where the danger is.
Yeah.
But the good news is that everybody knows if we start a war in North Korea and the Korean Peninsula, what really matters is not collapse of regime, but really matters is almost 26 million people. You do not want to create another Syria or Iraq in that area. And the bottom line is that if the war started, whoever can feed 26 million mouths, let me be very frank, will be the new master of North Korea. And South Korea does not want that to happen. I don't think United States, because after all, China is the only one that is capable of maintain stability in that region. And China does have pile up the food and everything, even the cadres. China has several million of Korean Chinese that speak Koreans, about 500,000 Korean cadres that speak Koreans. So I always told my American friends and the South Korean friends, be very careful. If you start war, it's China that has a capability to end the war. Look at Syria and Iraq. So it's not a good news. But on the other hand, I kind of beg to disagree with Yahweh that U.S. and China can stick together on North Korea. The bottom line is that both sides try to make North Korea the other side's problem. Americans say China's problem, China says America's problem. But nobody wants to take care. So my say is that both sides try to see who can hold down longest. Just like both you and I, sorry to say that I need to go to the bathroom, but let's say who can sit here longest will be the winner. Nobody wants to step out first. And that's the problem for Kim Jong-un, because Kim Jong-un's nightmare is nobody pay attention to him. So he wants either American or Chinese pay attention to me so I can survive. So I think we have to be very careful about Chinese terms. Chinese side, especially the policy establishment, has very carefully distinguished the state collapse and regime collapse. What Xi Jinping's trump card is that China, of course, does not want North Korea collapse as a nation state, but China could afford, should be able to afford the collapse of the regime. And that's how Kim Jong-un should understand that better. So in other way, I think that maybe the solution of North Korea is no solution. Let's hang on, see who can hang on last. Just keep it going. Let's see who is going to run out of gas.
No, the
at
issue
the
is what the issue Dr. here. Wong wrote the issue the analysis here. Is once it has a deliverable vehicle, you know, how long it takes for North Korea to have it. Are the U.S. and China going to react to that, or?
No, I think right now the problem is that Russia used to be a non-factor in North Korea issue, but now Russia is a factor.
No, Russia is back in.
Yeah, back in, because when China and United States agreed, first, to stop the coal import to China, second, to dramatically decrease supply of oil, we believe, and also to freeze the personal movement. We do not allow North Koreans to move around in the name of diplomats. Said, no, you just stay where you are and freeze the personal movement, stop import of coal, decrease dramatically the oil supply, and North Korea will eventually stand on its knees and say, look, we gave in, let's do open up and reform like China did. But now came Russia. Putin said, I cannot control my people to smuggle in the oil to North Korea. You want Putin stop it? Putin said, give me something. Yeah. So all of a sudden, Russia enables North Korea to survive. And Putin is a tough nut.
Yeah,
he's
Russia,
not going to give a free lunch. That's why Russia is
China
a factor
strategic
right
strategic
now.
Partners.
Russia is
can I just ask a clarification?
Basically, let me finish. All of a sudden, now Putin found out he has a game to play, and Putin is smartly. He is the one who can enable North Korea to survive as long as possible. Therefore, the problem will be there all the time. So that's the issue right now, in my view. Okay.
When you said that China, you know, they might not want it, but they can afford regime collapse, not nation-state collapse, mm-hmm. but regime collapse in North Korea. Can you elaborate on what you meant by that? Because I think I know what you meant by that, but I just want it clear.
I think that your policy is always made on the worst scenario, not the best scenario. So the worst scenario is that Kim Jong-un regime entirely collapsed. I think China is prepared to handle that. That's what I meant.
No, when you say Kim Jong-un regime collapsed, you mean the leadership structure is gone, or it's just a failed state like South Sudan?
No, I think that is just like what happened in Zimbabwe, and he could. It's not
okay, like a coup,
like a coup or like internal uprising,
it's
whatever.
Just a change of
or just like take him out.
Right.
I do not believe. I do not agree with just what Bob said that we don't know where to head. I think it can
we
take.
Do.
I think we depend on who this we mean.
No, the Chinese.
Chinese and Americans. As long as this guy keep talking, keep to communicate with his staff members, we can figure out where he is. That's not open, that top secret.
May you raise your hand?
I was going to bring up two things in terms of the challenges facing U.S. and China in terms of creating a platform or strategy on North Korea, because I agree that their interests align, but I think their tactics are different. And, you know, China wants dialogue, and what they've been pushing a lot is this freeze-a-freeze condition. So if, you know, North Korea will freeze tests, and then the U.S. and South Korea will freeze their annual exercises. But the problem is you have Trump yesterday saying that him and Xi Jinping talked and they were going to take that option off the table, and then MOFA spokesperson saying that's not off the table. And so I think, again, this is, you know, no one knows what's actually happening, what's happening in these meetings, but the optics of it, it just creates confusion. I think that's a real impediment to creating any sort of cooperation between the U.S. and China and North Korea. And then the other impediment is North Korea itself, especially in terms of, you know, China wants dialogue. I mean, I think most people, a lot of different parties want dialogue, but I don't think North Korea wants a dialogue. What's their incentive right now to come to the table?
I think North Korea wants a dialogue.
You think they do right now? But they're so close to getting
what
they wanted.
If you go back to history, at that time in 1991, United States, China, and all the major powers worked together to convince both Koreas to enter United Nations, basically recognize each other's legitimacy.
Okay.
And after that, China normalized relationship with South, but United States did not normalize relationship with North. So that's why they decided to go for nuclear. From that on, North Korea has one demand never changed. That is, they want direct dialogue with the United States, which will lead to normalization between the two countries. But to be frank, the United States will never give them that.
Right, you
the reason is very simple. If we normalize relationship with North Korea, then justification for U.S. troops deployed in South Korea will be gone. Or even U.S. rock alliance will be, justification will be gone, because U.S. rock alliance is a regional alliance, not like U.S. Japan alliance is a global alliance. whenever there's an enemy of the United States, unless US-Japan alliance is there. But if North Korea as a threat is gone because we normalize relation with North and China is no longer a threat in that region, Soviet Union collapse. So why we should keep US-Rock alliance? We're going to have a very strong resistance within Korean Peninsula against not only the deployment of US troops in the peninsula, but also against even US-Rock. And South Korea is going to drifting away. We understand that. So normalization with North Korea in that sense will be after the US-ROK alliance is guaranteed on some other basis, instead based on North Korea as a threat. So that's the reason.
You think Kim Jong-un has
And Kim Jong-un understand that, because Kim Jong-un knows that China will never, ever guarantee North Korea's national security. China will not fight
Especially
South Korea, United States on North Korea's behalf. So therefore, the only country has a key for all the three problems North Korea have. Number one, international isolation. Number two, national security. Number three, economic development. All the keys are in the hands of Washington, D.C. That's why he keeps looking, all his nuclear weapons, he keeps looking at Washington, D.C. I want to talk to you. Before that, we could allow, we have this strategy. So that's why I disagree with this term called strategic patience. I think it's a wrong term. Before that, North Korea did not have delivery capability. So we can hang on there as long as we want. It's China's problem, it's Japan's problem, it's South Korea's problem. And now all of a sudden, it's becoming our problem because of the rocket system. They can deliver now. That's why we have to pay
attention. Then what explains then the breakdown of like the Leap Day Agreement?
That was this dispute over the space launch. So as far as I understand, and it's unfortunate because there is no public statement on the Leap Day Agreement,
yes.
But from what we know, the U.S. said they set a freeze on North Korea's missile launches, which North Korea agreed to, but they did a satellite launch, and the U.S. said that constitutes a missile launch. So that's how the agreement fell apart.
I'm moving away from the North Korea issue. I had two questions for Bob. Just a point before I get to the questions, which separate point. And that is, you know, you were talking about what's the next framework. Personally, I think the next framework, at least for the next 3 years, will be the personal relationship between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump. That's the framework for U.S.-China relations. And we just hope that that relationship stays on a good, and that's as best as we can hope for. I also think it's important to note that, I mean, Donald Trump is not operating in a vacuum in terms of trade and economic issues. The Democrats never used to vote for trade agreements in the House of Republicans. The House of Representatives, the Republicans used to provide those votes, but now with the Bannon Republicans coming in with their more populist streak, it's not sure that the incumbent Republicans will be able to win back, to be able to defeat them. And so I think the whole consensus for trade agreements in the United States is going to be completely shot through, and it might even be for a full generation. So I think we are looking at a very important inflection point because this has ramifications for U.S. economic leadership in Asia. If U.S. cannot afford to provide that market access to its market or be willing to provide that openness, there's only so much it can demand out there. It'll get some, but it has real serious consequences. And so we don't have to give Donald Trump credit. He did something wrong in saying, we're not going for multilateral deals, but he's talking on the basis of a consensus in this country, which one has to recognize. My questions to Bob are two questions, very straightforward. One is, you know, Tsai Ing-wen is in Taiwan, and she's taken particular positions on the issue, on cross-strait issues, which is consonant with where the DPP is. Xi Jinping is obviously in this position of great power. But there's only so much he can do. I mean, he can become more assertive and aggressive, but as we saw at the 19th Party Congress, he went so far and not further in that regard. So were you the first question is, were you kind of expecting that to happen, or were you expecting that he might become a little more hardline on the Taiwan question for his next 5 years? Because that is going to coincide with Tsai Ing-wen's, at least for the next 2 or 3 years. The second question is this. It relates to Vietnam and Southeast Asia. There was always a question of Donald Trump's resolution an U.S. resolution towards maintaining U.S. presence in that area, especially with countries which it did not have alliances with. It has with Korea and Japan, which I mean really actionable alliances, but the others are not so sure. But what if you read the joint statements that have come out from the two meetings that Donald Trump has had with the Vietnamese, it's literally U.S. and Vietnam have not batted an eyelid. They've gone on exactly the way that they did under the Obama years. And so in that case, do you see that Donald Trump's arrival in office has impacted the relationship, or is the relationship just going to be going on the way it was the previous five years for the next 5 years?
Well, obviously, the trade relationship will be different, right, with Vietnam.
Now, yes.
Vietnam runs a large trade surplus with the United States. The Trump people have made that an issue. but I think the security, this is my basic point, I think the security strategy is there. I mean, it's a matter of strengthening the U.S. forces, strengthening our relationship with allies and partners, doing it very methodically with an idea that China is the main concern. And the chief of staff of the Joint Chiefs went to China, had a visit, came back, told the Senate Armed Services Committee, in 2025, China will be the biggest problem we face strategically and militarily.
Yes.
So that's what Ash Carter wanted to do. That's what Bob Work wanted to do in the previous government. It's sort of they were underway here, but Obama kept that in a box, basically. He didn't allow that to influence the policy. Well, now the military does whatever they want in that sense, because they're in charge of the NSC, they're in charge of the chief of staff, and of course the defense minister is a military officer retired. So I think this is a steady thing. And then when they say the Indo-Pacific, that means it's the same. To me, it means the same strategic thing as Obama's rebalance, because it says we have to keep this secure way to get to the India. And to get to India, you have to go through Southeast Asia. It has to be kept secure. So it puts it right in the middle of the strategy. And I think that's, on a military point of view, I think that's going to continue. On the hard line on Taiwan, this is one of the things that it's a little counterintuitive. I don't want to belabor this. People get very excited about the power of Xi Jinping in foreign affairs. And I just think this is really a mistake. They're really missing a lot. And they're missing the fact that Chinese foreign relations, the most important arena for Chinese foreign relations, 70% of their activity is around the rim of China. Please look at the rim. And when you look at the rim, you see big problems. And so their relationships, and Taiwan is top of the list. And they don't have an answer for this. They don't have an answer for North Korea. They want the Americans to solve it. It's an American problem, and because they can't solve it themselves. And they made big problems with South Korea. And then Japan, we all know how Japan feels. Then Southeast Asia, South China Sea, they're weaker. They've been able to coerce these people. And so they're consolidating that now. But basically, the U.S. is there. What the U.S. will do in this one, I don't know. The Trump people have not been speaking much about this. So I'm not sure what they're going to do in the South China Sea. But the point is, and then there's India. And all of these areas are big trouble for China, which they don't have an answer for, except this, our largesse, and if you don't do our largesse, we'll pressure you like we did to the Koreans, and or the Singaporeans or others. They just do this sort of thing. And that doesn't go over well. And so these countries are wary in various forms of resistance to the Chinese. So just your paradigm of they could go one way or the other, they go both ways. they go both ways at the same time. But in the background is DOD. The background is the United States. Webs of military relationships are everywhere in the region, and they're getting stronger in the face of what they see as a danger they have to deal with. And it's not that they want to fight, but they're going to have to deal with this thing. And Xi Jinping has said, we're going to do it. We're going to have the China dream. We're going to just do these things in the region, and that's that. Get used to it. It's a new era. This is what we're going to do. And the Peace Development Road, they don't talk about that anymore. They used to, and when the Peace Development Road was announced, they would say, they would reassure the Americans all the time.
This went on.
You mean the Belt and?
No. The Peace Development Road. This is a diving wars. This is the Peaceful Rise period.
Right.
From 2002 until 2009, they kept doing this.
Right.
Then I visited China in 2015. I said, "You guys used to reassure the United States all the time. You don't do that anymore." They said, "Yeah, we don't do that anymore." It was a sign of weakness. So they're not doing that anymore. I mean, I think everybody knows that in the United States. They say, "Yeah, they're not going to back away. So we have to get ready." And so it's sort of pushback time. Mm-hmm. And on the DoD side, I think that's where we are. And so the trade side, it's a mess. I agree. But so Taiwan, why doesn't he do this on Taiwan? Because he can't. It's counterproductive. He can't do it. He puts a lot of pressure on them. Then what's going to happen? Does he want a big flare-up on the Taiwan issue today? I don't think so.
Taiwan's a liability,
man. Maybe, but I mean, it's not with all these other problems. I don't think so. So just take the image of big, powerful Xi Jinping and put these array of problems, and you get a different perspective. And it's a guy that he's got lots of problems, and that's just I'm not talking internally. I'm talking externally. To me, just looking at tactically, I saw how Xi Jinping dealt with Obama, and it was very iterative, expanding in various ways without hitting nerves that would make Obama really react. He shouted a lot, but he didn't do it much, and so he kept doing it. And the South China Sea is the graphic example, but he did this on cyber theft. He did this on all sorts of issues. Hillary Clinton captured this in the campaign. He says, this is what she said, they repeatedly game us. They repeatedly manipulate things and to their advantage, and in the end, we get the raw deal. And that feeling is widespread, it seems to me. And so Trump is trying to rectify that in his own way, but the military feels the same way, I think. They say, yeah, this hasn't worked, but we're gonna get ready. We have to get ready. We have no choice. We're going to get ready. And so I think that's where we seem to be right now.
So basically, I think we're going to go through the last round.
Yeah.
And so the question, I guess, again, you know, initiated by Bob, is there's no framework. So why, you know, last night, Ambassador Barker said there's a moral obligation for us to maintain this mutually beneficial relationship. But he's saying all these Americans, if we put them on the Boeing 747, they go to China, they live there for a while, you know, DoD people in particular. I mean, they will figure China out. China is not going to be a threat. So how do we overcome this, that China is not going to go away. China's rise is not going to be a peaceful rise.
China is a threat in lots of ways. What do you mean it's not going to be a threat? I mean, that's an assumption. And I think
that... No, I'm just saying, my question to everyone is, in what way, you know, really China is threatening the core interest of the U.S. And if the two countries, leaders and the people, including us here, sitting, talking in a wrong way, How we remove that this zero sum?
I think we have to deal with it.
All right, so we go through
from
here.
Bob,
I know you have to go.
Yeah, number one, there's not much option in terms of policy vis-a-vis China. That's a problem. There's not policy. Number two is that with a red line, if you said the response, who's drawing the red line? I think the problem is that China, United States like this, so that China policy has become an internal issue. United States want to work out the China policy, the first fight started in Washington, D.C. and New York, Wall Street. So therefore, that's why you need a strong leader. I always argue that U.S.-China relationship, stability of the relationship depends on the leadership on both sides who is capable to control internal politics. Because if we work a policy towards China, if Wall Street says, yeah, great policy, the defense ministry will be pissed off. If we work policy, the energy industry, yeah, great policy, then the environment people will be pissed off. If manufacturer likes the policy, then labor union will be pissed off. If manufacturer like it, maybe human rights will be pissed off. So it's a constant fight, internal fight
on how we're going to deal with China. That's what. And in China, the same thing. If Xi Jinping work out the policy that Minister of Foreign Affairs like it, maybe Minister of Defense will be pissed off. Mm-hmm. If Shanghai like it, Sichuan will be pissed off. Mm-hmm. So it's internal kind of policy unification that matters about bilateral relationship. That's why. That's why we
can. And you have a president in the United States who doesn't care too much about it.
Yeah, that's a problem. So internally, it's an internal stability.
He cares about his constituency, who he tweets all the time.
So I do not believe DOD can work alone in dealing with China.
Of course
not.
No. And DOD isn't uniform either.
They don't have much options in dealing with China. Vice versa, to China is true. So therefore, maybe this kind of hanging on together will be a normal.
Could be.
That's a framework.
Yeah, but I think it'll be tense. That's the point.
Yeah,
it
will be
it's
tense.
Not easy. To
but
do. Sorry, I have to go.
Both countries are big enough, strong enough to handle the tense relationship.
Sorry.
So we'll just go through around the table and complete this.
I have the starting point.
Okay, very briefly. I find that there is the big difference between the U.S. agenda and the China agenda. Very big difference because I think in China, in our position, I think in the Asia, the most the priority issue is development, is a poverty reduction, is a infrastructure construction, is a industrialization, not a North Korea issue. A North Korea issue is very, very important, but the needed time, needed dialogue, needed the patience. The patience, not patience for the collapse of North Korea, the patience for the dialogue. I think this is very, very serious. It's a very complicated issue. We need time. I think we can look back the 1.5 years ago. Maybe in this time, we were talking about the South China Sea issue. But now, we don't care the South China issue. We care the North Korea issue. I think the next year, maybe in Washington, in the D.C., people shifted attention to another security issue. But believe us, in the Asia, the local people don't most concern about North Asia, not North Korea. Concern about the poverty reduction, the development, the infrastructure, and the industrialization. The job, this is a very big the difference in the two countries' Asian agendas.
Sure.
But so I think it's exchange, communication is very important.
Well, after listening to discussion, my assumption, may I assume that the North Korea issues compared with the other five questions we posed, that would be the most important one. But when I listen to Councillor Wang's observation, probably not really the answer, just because we have a lot of experience working on this issue. So I think I want to go back to Professor Huang's earlier point. It's very important to observe what's the potential result for China in Asia Pacific. He pointed out either the other countries around Southeast Asia and Northeast Asia is going to work together with China. Like we hear the China-Philippine statement and China-Vietnam statement, a lot of very good example. And the other another scenario he's suggesting that other countries going to work together to stand against China. I think both scenarios that's worth observing. And I think one of the example that we could try to notice that, for instance, this TPP, this new concept of comprehensive programs, TPP, versus the regional economic, RCEP. Because a lot of the countries are involving both mechanisms. So we see at this point, we might see more progress on the CPTPP than the RCEP. So that's another direction that we should focus on. But I think I'm very glad that the South China Sea issue, maybe in this year or the coming next year, will not be the top priority for China and U.S. to handle the relationship, which means I can travel less to Asia and then give a last presentation on the South China Sea. Okay.
Well, I've spoken enough, so why don't you let me not have anything more to say.
No, just very brief. The first is about the freeze. In fact, that's from a Chinese word, 冻结, but we translate it as suspension.
双暂停,
suspension, false suspension, not freeze. Because there's totally different meaning. Freeze, it seems that just make something frozen, just untouched. But suspension, it means, yeah, that is the first step. Yeah. So all the relevant parties show some, show some friendly status, and at least we can sit at the table and can try, try other opportunities. And the last thing is about, I think that's perspective. Of course, Professor Huang also has said China has to put so many theories to be understood by the other people. And Professor Sutter also said the peaceful development. In Chinese theory trace, there has a long tradition. In different eras, there's a different emphasis. So now we try to establish a comprehensive framework of the theory, China, how to deal with the world. So the peaceful development has been emphasis several years ago, and now that is still one part of China's diplomacy theory. But now, because China has a bigger role and need to deal with more issues, now the theory seems more comprehensive than before. So I think Professor Huang has raised a very good question that can make us think how to put ourselves understood by the other people. So Director Liu has said the Ambassador Bok has moral obligation remark. That is a very important task for all the international relations experts. See how to. Everyone agrees that the nuclear war is unacceptable, but how can we work to achieve a more reasonable goal? That's quite a complicated process and needs us to exert so many efforts. Thank you.
Okay. You want to?
Yeah, I think let's be very frank with each other. I think that now the world is under two fundamental and irrevocable trends. One trend called global economic integration. Nobody can stop it because it's not resulted from anybody's policy, but from market forces. The second trend is we're moving from a unipolar world to a multipolar world. And if you look at U.S.-China relations, you can see that two countries have a fundamental conflict on both trends. United States under Obama administration, at least United States want to work with China to promote global economic integration. But now we have Donald Trump and the Washington establishment, the one issue they agree with each other is they want America first. They do not want to this kind of so-called integration because they think, or we think, United States, Americans think we're shortchanged in the global integration. And China is launching a short. So we want to stop that. So even that part is gone. A second part, another trend is from unipolar to multipolar. That is absolutely two countries head to head. United States want unipolar, of course. We're very comfortable at this position. Why not give it up? But China, of course, want to promote at least multipolar world. So on that part, the two countries have very little room to compromise. So that's an issue. It doesn't matter how you tell a story. This side simply don't want to hear about it because our fundamental interest is against your fundamental interests, just like Bob said. But the problem is, although China is a weaker party, but China is a rising power, so China ride on these two trends because the both trends benefit China. China both benefit from it and also want to promote it. But United States charged a short chain from both sides. So therefore, China is taking all the initiatives because China 顺潮而做, Chinese follow the trend. United States is against trend, so whatever United States is doing is passive. Yeah. So good news and bad news. And how to do that, I think three things can be done. Number one, we are going to try to institutionalize bilateral relationship. That's why I want to go back to Jim Steinberg's strategic reassurance. Strategic reassurance, I don't mean that he's my good friend, so that's why I always like. I like his idea. I think Jim's idea is not to strategic reassurance, it's all about how we formalize a bilateral relationship so our behavior against each other become predictable. That's the first thing we need to do. Second, we should try to drag the United States, or United States try to drag China into, we drag it into back into global integration, economic integration. That's work for both sides. That's why I think Donald Trump is especially a problem here, because he's against it. That's the second. That is through all those dialogues, let's work together on global integration, and because both major powers can benefit from those. The third and last thing we want to do is a crisis management mechanism. And when Bob here, he did not have time to listen to me, but he know where I stand. We've been debating each other for a long, long time. I think that DOD is not a problem.
Bob Manning or Bob Sutter?
Bob Sutter. Mm-hmm. Bob Manning, I know him more. Bob Sutter. DOD is not a problem. The problem is that we still do not have a kind of mechanism that both sides can have effective and timely dialogue. I mean, military to military. If you look at U.S.-China relationship, the weakest part is military to military, is security issue, because it's least institutionalized relationship.
That's
a problem, because especially now the DOD is more and more like an independent force in U.S. politics. They don't really listen to Bob, Donald Trump. Look, last time after my local conference, Tillerson came out saying we're going to have a peaceful negotiation with North Korea. Barely his words is gone, Vincent went to North Korea. This time when Donald Trump's still in Asia, three battle groups, it's obviously it's not Donald Trump's decision, it's a DOD's decision. So that's very, very dangerous. When you have a major power which have a military that does not really really listen to the chief of commander or commander-in-chief, to me that's a problem. Sometimes, for example, the Vincent carrier, under any precedent, that's unconstitutional. How could you cheat? Your own commander-in-chief said, we're going to North Korea, but actually you're going to Australia, and then coming back 4 days later. That is unconstitutional. But nobody take responsibility for that.
But Trump believes in his generals. Yeah. He doesn't.
He believes in his generals because he knows he cannot control his generals. That's why he gave it up. That's very, very dangerous. By the way, long term is against Americans' fundamental interest to have a military that act on its own. But who you can blame for? Blame Donald Trump or blame Jim Master? Jim Mattis. Especially now we have Jim Mattis, McMaster, and Kaylee, and also John, and they're good friends to each other. They know how to deal with it. John is close friend to James Mattis.
Just one sentence. The military to military relation is very important to the bilateral relations. And the Secretary of Defense Mattis has been decided to visit China early next year. And also other military communication mechanisms will gradually
develop. Since you mentioned that, I would say that there is one problem. United States military is much more open than Chinese military.
Right.
That's when you talk about mill-to-mill exchange. Chinese military, more often than not, Chinese military hand is bound from behind. They cannot do mill-to-mill. That's a problem. But Pentagon can make decisions. But Bai Dalo cannot make its decision. That's a problem.
But you know, over the past 3 years, there have actually been quite a lot of forward progress on this. And at this point of time, it's that the dynamic for forward progress on mill institutionalization and conversation, actually the prognosis is pretty good for the next 2-3 years, or at least for through this term. And Obama, from about 2014, Susan Rice kind of started that process. So I think that's on a good track, at least.
Can only talk in White House, after White House. Outside the White House, nobody listens to Susan Rice, sorry to say that.
I have to head out, but thank you very much.
All right. So I guess we'll have
say hi to all those
Spooky
people.
I have nothing to add.
Okay.
So I think a good summation of this entire discussion goes to the framework. And I think we've all kind of seen that the framework is chaos, right? There is no cohesive Asia policy, and that goes for every continent, right? Like the way that Trump deals with Europe, with the Americas, with Africa, it's all the same. And as Bob pointed out, he loves tension. So we keep saying, like, we're waiting for the Asia policy to roll out, we're waiting for it to roll out. Like, why would we expect that? He likes the status quo. He thrives on the status quo, right? So I think that's one observation I have from this whole meeting. And then also, just going very briefly back to the North Korea issue to sum it up, I think it's fair to say that, you know, we keep saying, like, we have a North Korea problem. The whole world has a North Korea problem. I don't necessarily think that's true. We have an America problem. It's the United States that's talking about preventative war, right? North Korea has constantly said, like, we have acquired these weapons because we saw what happened to Saddam Hussein when he gave up his weapons of mass destruction. He died. We saw what happened to Gaddafi when he gave up his weapons of mass destruction. He died in a ditch. That's not going to happen to us. So they've developed nuclear weapons to protect themselves.
So perfectly rational, right?
It seems perfectly rational. And we keep saying that he's irrational. We can't allow him to have delivery vehicles. First of all, that ship has sailed. Shelled a decade ago when they first tested a nuclear device. They have short-range ballistic missiles and medium-range ballistic missiles and intermediate-range ballistic missiles that are proven delivery vehicles. The only question now is the ICBM, and that's what America's freaking out about. Anyways, though, I really think that speaks volumes, that we have an American problem because America is unwilling to accept deterrence that Bob Manning put it out has worked for 70 years. So, I don't know. That's my final observation.
So on that, we conclude today's roundtable.
Thank you, Dr. Liu, for facilitating this.
Thanks for inviting me, and I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would like to thank all of you, including those have to leave. This is a busy time, busy season.
Yeah.
I have the Thanksgiving next week, so I appreciate your comments, and hopefully we can bring you back for our future event, either this kind of similar roundtable discussion or seminars or public lectures. So we look forward to meeting you again very soon.